Maya Angelou. For many years, Angelou wrote exclusively in hotel or motel rooms. The more anonymous, the better. In 1983, she told an interviewer, "I keep a hotel room in which I do my work, a tiny, mean room with just a bed, and sometimes, if I can find it, a face basin. I keep a dictionary, a Bible, a deck of cards, and a bottle of sherry in the room. I try to get there around 7, and I work until 2 in the afternoon. If the work is going badly, I stay until 12:30. If it's going well, I'll stay as long as it's going well. It's lonely, and it's marvelous."
Welcome to Subject, Object, Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. What you just heard was the Los Angeles writer, Mason Curry, describing the daily routine of Maya Angelou. Curry has written a pair of books titled Daily Rituals, which chronicle the practices, routines, and habits of artists, scientists, and philosophers. That was an excerpt. Here's another.
Beethoven rose at dawn and wasted little time getting down to work. His breakfast was coffee, which he prepared himself with great care. He determined that there should be 60 beans per cup, and he often counted them out one by one for a precise dose. Then he sat at his desk and worked until 2 or 3 in the afternoon, taking the occasional break to walk outdoors, which aided his creativity. The other crucial aid to his creativity was bathing, which Beethoven did in an unusual fashion. According to his secretary, quote, "If he did not dress to go out during the morning working hours, Beethoven would stand undressed at his washstand and pour large pitchers of water over his hands, bellowing up and down the scale or sometimes humming loudly to himself. Then he would stride around his room with rolling or staring eyes, jot something down, then resume his pouring of water and loud singing. These were moments of deep meditation, to which no one could have objected but for 2 unfortunate consequences. First of all, the servants would often burst out laughing. This made the master angry, and he would sometimes assault them in language that made him cut an even more ridiculous figure. Or secondly, he would come into conflict with the landlord. For all too often, so much water was spilled that it went right through the floor. This was one of the main reasons for Beethoven's unpopularity as a tenant. The floor of his living room would have had to be covered with asphalt to prevent all that water from seeping through. And the master was totally unaware of the excess of inspiration under his feet."
Subject, object, verb is our way of describing the relationship between the artist, the art, and the life as it is lived. So this episode will focus deeply on the verb, the way artists live, and the way they structure their moments into routine and ritual. A ritual can be as simple as preparing morning coffee, as meticulous as working according to a strictly timed schedule, and as elaborate as a séance to evoke spiritual entities for assistance in the creative act. This is the sound of a Fluxus action by the artist Allison Knowles. It's called Nivea Cream Piece. It premiered in 1962, and it transforms the common ritualistic act of moisturizing one's skin into a performance. Here are the written instructions Knowles gives for executing the work.
"The performers enter, and each lathers up his arms and face with cream, then his colleagues, in a fragrant pig pile."
Later in the episode, the artist and teacher Natalie Labriola will discuss female mystic artists, such as Anna Mendieta, Betty Saar, and Georgiana Houghton, all who work with elaborate performance rituals. We'll also hear from the artist Candace Lynn, who gives a nice surreal eulogy to a feral cat that used to frequent her front porch.
Patricia Highsmith. The author of such psychological thrillers as Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley was, in person, as solitary and misanthropic as some of her heroes. Writing was less a source of pleasure for her than a compulsion, without which she was miserable. Quote, "There is no real life except in working, that is to say, in the imagination, she wrote in her journal. Fortunately, Highsmith was rarely short of inspiration. She had ideas, she said, like rats have orgasms. Highsmith wrote daily, usually for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, completing 2,000 words on a good day. The biographer Andrew Wilson records her methods as follows. Her favorite technique to ease herself into the right frame of mind for work was to sit on her bed surrounded by cigarettes, ashtray, matches, a mug of coffee, a donut, and an accompanying saucer of sugar. She had to avoid any sense of discipline and make the act of writing as pleasurable as possible. Her position, she noted, would be almost fetal, and indeed, her intention was to create, she said, a womb of her own. Highsmith was also in the habit of having a stiff drink before she started to write. Not to perk her up, Wilson notes, but to reduce her energy levels, which veered toward the manic. In her later years, as she became a hardened drinker with a high tolerance, she kept a bottle of vodka by her bedside, reaching for it as soon as she woke and marking the bottle to set her limit for the day. She was also a chain smoker for most of her life, going through a pack of Galois a day. In matters of food, she was indifferent. One acquaintance remembered that, quote, she only ever ate American bacon, fried eggs, and cereal, all at odd times of the day. Ill at ease around most people, she had an unusually intense connection with animals, particularly cats, but also snails, which she bred at home. Highsmith was inspired to keep the gastropods as pets when she saw a pair at a fish market locked in a strange embrace. She later told a radio interviewer that they give me a sort of tranquility. She eventually housed 300 snails in her garden at Suffolk, England, and once arrived at a London cocktail party carrying a gigantic handbag that contained a head of lettuce and 100 snails, her companions for the evening, she said. When she later moved to France, Highsmith had to get around the prohibition against bringing live snails into the country. So she smuggled them in, making multiple trips across the border, with 6 to 10 of the creatures hidden under each breast.
Each of these daily rituals suggests a kind of repetition. Fried eggs, bacon, and cigarettes. Mean rooms, pitchers of water, and snails. Repetition of elements allows the monkey mind to turn itself off. You don't have to think. This allows a new kind of mind to emerge. This is why monks will walk through the same door with the same foot at the same time every day. Every decision you remove allows more space for the divine inspiration. Many artists turn into hermits. Last episode, we spoke with Josh Smith, who discussed the nature of reclusive living. David Lynch is another hermetic artist who prefers to never leave his compound. He lives and works through the process of repetition. He has a strict twice-a-day meditation practice that he says he hasn't broken in 50 years. This is also how he eats, the same meals every day. This is his music you're hearing.
I like things to be orderly, Lynch told a reporter in 1990. For 7 years, I ate at Bob's Big Boy. I would go at 2:30, after the lunch rush. I ate a chocolate shake and 4, 5, 6, 7 cups of coffee with lots of sugar. And there's lots of sugar in that chocolate shake. It's a thick shake in a silver goblet. I would get a rush from all this sugar, and I would get so many ideas. I would write them on these napkins. It was like I had a desk with paper. All I had to do was remember to bring my pen, but a waitress would give me one if I remembered to return it at the end of my stay. I got a lot of ideas at Bob's.
Recently, Lynch has started a YouTube channel that seems to externalize his extremely repetitive life. Every day in the morning, sitting in the same chair, he posts a short weather report, which is usually a variation on this.
Good morning. It's July 13, 2020, and it's a Monday already. Here in L.A., blue skies, golden sunshine coming along, very still right now, around 65 degrees Fahrenheit, 18 Celsius. Should be going up to the mid-80s this afternoon, around 29 Celsius. Sunshine will be with us all along the way.
Repetition is a way of grounding the artist against the volatile, fickle nature of the imagination, which can just as easily flip from generating ideas to destroying them, from faith to fear, from ecstasy to despair.
So the playwright Lillian Hellman, she said that she, on a daily basis, she worked through successions of elation, depression, hope. So she starts off the day feeling elated. She's doing great work. This is brilliant. I'm a genius. And then around the middle of the day, she looks at what she's accomplished and she's sunk in a depression because, no, wait, this is terrible. And then the last note is hope, like, I'm going to do better tomorrow. And I kind of feel like that also operates on a more macro scale. You know, it's like the elation of making the thing and then maybe the kind of depression of being done and having this dead space between things, between projects, and then the hope of like getting excited about the next one.
Throughout the episode, you've been hearing excerpts like these from a project called Fresh Bread by a musician named Sam Gendel. He posted a new track online every day during the first 67 days of coronavirus lockdown. Like a good drug, routinized habits place the artist into a kind of trance. So it makes sense that mood and mind-altering substances are part of many, many, many artists' routines.
W.H. Auden. To maintain his energy and concentration, the poet relied on amphetamines, taking a dose of benzedrine each morning, the way many people take a daily multivitamin. At night, he used secanol or another sedative to get to sleep. He continued this routine, the chemical life, he called it, for 20 years, until the efficacy of the pills finally wore off. Auden regarded amphetamines as one of the, quote, labor-saving devices in the mental kitchen, alongside alcohol, coffee, and tobacco. Although he was well aware that, quote, these mechanisms are very crude, liable to injure the cook, and constantly breaking down.
Rituals often become a source and expression of belief. Repeat something enough times and you can become fearful of breaking the pattern. Achieve success through a certain way of thinking or acting, and you can become confident that that is the only way to live.
Truman Capote was a very superstitious person, and he had all these rules about he couldn't start or end anything on a Friday. He had certain numbers that were unlucky, so he could only leave so many cigarette butts in an ashtray, and he could only stay in certain hotel rooms that had lucky numbers. I think he could only dial certain telephone numbers that were lucky. And his routine was something great. Like, he said he could only write lying down, and his day was sort of this progression of coffee to mint tea to sherry to martinis.
When you put all these practices together, repetition, belief, creation, and maybe a helpful substance, ritual becomes a sacred ceremony. These elements encode a kind of meaning into the activity and whatever objects or feelings that activity produces. What you're hearing is the music of Astral Oracles, a Los Angeles-based, quote, open source community that performs rituals intended to stimulate different states they refer to as dimensions. This is the music from a ritual they performed in Bulgaria, and it's intended to activate certain dimensions that have names like 111 and 999. every one of these dimensions is linked to a smell, a shape, a feeling, a color. And the rituals bring all these together at once to go beyond language. Here's one of their members, an artist who goes by the name L.
Language can't even begin to approximate the things that we experience, you know, it's just beyond even description. So we're interested in things that can't be put into words. And that's really what all these dimensions are about. It's why they're difficult to describe, but you kind of just have to experience it all, which people that are listening to it, they are in part through the sound here.
Natalie Labriola, another Los Angeles-based artist, teaches a course on the history of female mystic artists at the Golden Dome, which is, and this is a quote from their website, an educational and curatorial platform dedicated to studying intersections of art, metaphysics, and ecology. The class includes discussions of Carita Kent, Agnes Martin, Emma Kunz, and many others. These artists often transform the act of art making into a ritual. Here's Labriola discussing yet another Los Angeles artist, Betty Saar, who is now a healthy looking 93 and is getting wider attention for her work. She began showing in the 1970s with assemblages and sculptures that often express the mystical side of life.
The process of art making, she describes it as this sort of fourfold ritual, in which the first part involves her going out into the world and collecting these used objects, usually from flea markets or garage sales, objects that have been discarded, that are no longer deemed valuable. And she describes this as a very intuitive process where she will just kind of allow herself to be led to different objects that speak to her. Then the second part is when she takes them back to her studio and she kind of gathers them, a bunch of different objects, and sits with them and kind of allows the objects to speak to her and to tell her what kind of story that they want to tell and how she can sort of fuse her own ideas and narratives into them. Then the third stage of this process is where she puts her own hand into it, kind of alchemizes these objects into art through her own hand by gluing things together, collaging things, cutting, painting. And then the fourth step of the process is when she releases them out into the world. And then she considers the ritual of art making to be complete at this point.
In her class, Labriola draws out the entire lineage of female mystic artists, and she refers to the great Hildegard von Bingen as the godmother of them all. Hildegard was a Benedictine abbess, writer, healer, herbalist, and composer who lived in the 12th century during the golden age of Christian female mystics, like Marjorie Kemp and Saint Teresa. Hildegard was canonized as a saint and was known for her intense visions, which she transformed into writing and music.
She composed Ordo Virtutum, which means Order of the Virtues, which was an allegorical morality play and musical drama in 1152. And she composed this entirely by the visions that she received. So she heard the music and she saw the visions for the play. She wasn't trained as a musician and she wasn't trained to compose music, but she created this really rich musical drama that she describes as hearing through her inner ear. And this consisted of over 77 songs about God and morality and kind of the struggle between good and evil. And this play became a sort of ritual in the sense that it became performed. It was performed, and the act of performance itself ritualizes this narrative. She also designed costumes and set, and this act alone of designing costumes and set and allowing women to wear dresses and have long hair was pretty radical for the time. Most women in the monastery would have had shaved heads, would have had to be dressed in very humble clothing. And so to see women performing this with these gowns, these like rich gowns with gold threads and silks and long hair, would have been pretty groundbreaking.
The line between performance and ritual is a thin one. For example, the artist Anna Mendieta showed her work in the 70s, and she often used her body in ritualistic performances. She said, "Through my earth body sculptures, I become an extension of nature, and nature becomes an extension of my body." This obsessive act of reasserting my ties with the earth is really the reactivation of primeval beliefs.
They were private rituals, meaning that she performed them alone, but they were documented, and the documentation of them became the artworks. So they sort of blurred the line between a performance and a ritual, or the nature of the public versus the private performance in that sense. She would kind of seek out these places in nature that she felt a resonance with, that she wanted to create a connection with that landscape. And she would return to these places again and again and fulfill a series of ritual actions, which would in turn produce these artworks. And the materials of these performances would be natural materials, burnt wood, sand, waves, a grassy meadow, fire, into a hole dug in the ground, a bed of flowers, bundle of branches, water trapped in ice, her own menstrual blood. These were like the tools that she used to enact her rituals that were designed to bring her into close contact with the earth itself.
In the last few years, art made through seances has drawn wider interest, mostly because of the discovery of the work of Hilma af Klint, who is now considered to be one of the earliest abstract painters. The work of Georgiana Houghton, a 19th century artist from the Canary Islands, was also abstract and also inspired by seance work, decades before Klint. Houghton's work was private. She only exhibited once in her lifetime, and the drawings have only recently started seeing public view. These are intricate, cosmological-looking scribbles, channeled from the beyond.
Georgiana Houghton was a British artist and spiritualist medium, born in 1814, who created a body of really lush, abstract watercolors that evolved out of a series of seances that she did in the mid-1800s. Houghton would attempt to make contact with these other forces by the ritual of a seance. And her ritual tools were these sort of rudimentary Ouija board objects called planchettes, which was this wooden heart-shaped device fit with casters and a little hole for a pencil that she would use to help her sort of animate the spirit drawings that she would produce from these seances. So this was the 1860s, and the spiritualist movement was growing in popularity across Europe. And she started attending seances because she had lost her younger sister and her younger brother and wanted to contact them. So she initially took up these attempts at spirit communication with her mother, where they would sit at their kitchen table and for 3 months every day sit at the table and wait to receive these messages. And at the time, a popular form of spirit communication was called table tipping, where with hands rested on the table, you would wait for small movements of the table and letters to be communicated one at a time through these kind of spirit tappings and movements. So after a year of working with this planchette as her tool to create these drawings, she abandoned that entirely and just began making drawings with her own hands. So in her work, what she was depicting, even though it was abstract, to her, it was a representation of a spiritual reality. These were things that she saw as physically existing in sort of in the spiritual realm. She describes them as real objects growing in spirit regions and not simply allegorical as she had previously thought. She came to understand them as real.
The only writer Labriola teaches in her course is a poet living in Pittsburgh named C.A. Conrad. Here's a reading by C.A.
Sky-linking skin, the moon heaves tide of tears in a new direction. Potted flowers sitting on other side of war intact. Rereading my first poetry notebook, excitement of surrendering to the spirits is what remains. Looking and listening with the dead who unlace my syntax. Cooked to the bone. A copy of the poem for the defense, another for the prosecution. Aiding and abetting my absorption of more than the allowable amount of light. Borders, spirits have told me, are flesh in every way to be transgressed as champion and traitor alike.
C.A. works closely with ritual and has written several books using a practice called somatic rituals, involving performances as a way of generating poetry. Here's Labriola describing one of Conrad's rituals.
So this ritual involves washing a penny, slipping it under your tongue, and walking outside your house. And the penny is important because it's the medal of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. So they recommend that you drink some orange juice and kind of wash the juice around in your mouth with the penny. And do this because oranges are the fruit associated with Aphrodite. And then go sit outside somewhere and think about the question, what is the best love you've ever had in this world? So while you're quietly thinking about this, keep the penny in your mouth and ignore any passerbys that might come your way. So then they say to take the penny out of your mouth after a little while, place it on your head, balance it there, and let it sit for a while. And after a few moments of sitting still, get out your pen and paper and write about poverty. They say write line after line about starvation and deprivation from the voice of one who has been loved in the world.
Here's a clip of Conrad from the documentary Rituals for Poetry.
It excites me so much to get up in the morning and do these rituals. It's my whole life. And it has deeply affected me, this creating this space where I'm present. It's affected everything that I do. I mean, yes, I've cured myself of depression with it, and I'm doing political actions with it. But it's helping me see that literally everything around me is alive in some way. And I think the thing that I love the most is that it makes me appreciate everything all day long, and how I'm present all the time now for the first time in my life. And it's because of these rituals. The power of the rituals for changing my life in a way is that I do them every day. And in doing that, being focused on the present, I'm present for everything all the time. For instance, I was in Marfa, Texas on a residency. I love Marfa, Texas. And I was doing a ritual that I called Marfa Poetry Machine and 36 Rituals, where I did 36 rituals a day for 36 days. I went to the post office at one point, and while I was about to enter the post office, a car pulled up playing the radio very loud, and it was a song from my childhood called Band of Gold, the pop song. And I stood there listening to the song. I hadn't heard it in many years. And I was thinking, oh, that's what the lyrics are. And what are those musical instruments? Is that, you know, trying to figure out, suss out all the nuances of what's going on inside that structure of that song. And then the song was over and I went to the post office and went about my day. And later on that evening when I was making dinner, I realized how important that was. Because if I had heard that song before I started doing these rituals back in 10 years ago or whatever, I would have been hooked and dragged into nostalgia, thinking about my childhood. I wasn't interested in doing that at all. I was present for that song in a way that I think I probably would have never been if I didn't live my life the way I'm living it right now.
At the end of every episode, we feature an artist in our 433 column, in which artists can fill the space of 4 minutes and 33 seconds in whatever way they see fit. This episode's columnist is Candace Lynn, who has worked with ritual throughout her career and who has collaborated with Conrad on the somatic rituals. In her work, she draws on historical rituals around gender, health, and colonialism. In one of her watercolors, she depicts the navel ritual of a person's first crossing of the equator, which usually includes a baptism of some kind. Lynn told me that the following work imagines the last day on Earth of her feral cat friend named White and Gray. Since recording this piece for the show, it's turned into the start of a new science fiction story that develops White and Gray's journey into an alternate reality, which he accesses through eating indigo, then fermenting in his belly and vomiting it up into a pool of blue liquid that allows him to see the micropolitics of a world where kingdoms of viruses and bacteria war to control the mind of humans and all mammals. Written partly as a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan fiction, with characters played by cats, opossums, and raccoons, the story will be logged in an indigo-bound journal and as an accompanying sound piece inside an indigo fabric sculpture, which will open next summer at the Walker Art Center and the Harvard Carpenter Center for the Arts. One time I tried to pet White and Gray, but Candace quickly pulled me away, warning me that I would surely be clawed. This was not a house pet. Before you hear that wonderful finale, I wanted to say that if you enjoyed Mason Curry's daily rituals, I recommend subscribing to his Subtle Maneuvers newsletter, which I'm always grateful to see in my inbox. And if you enjoyed the Fresh Bread music throughout the show, I recommend checking out freshbread.bandcamp or listening to Sam Gendel's new album, Satin Doll, which released on Nonesuch a few months ago. This song is not by Fresh Bread, though. This is our subject-object-verb theme composed by me. If you have any thoughts on anything pertaining to anything, feel free to drop us a note at subject-object-verb@artreview.com. We are very good emailers. Thanks for listening. Here's Candace.
The flesh lumps called me WG, short for White and Gray, but you could have also called me blue-green on account of the heterochromia, my striking eyes, that no one could resist. I lived on that vomit-stained porch for 11 years, though I roamed for the first 9. The cafeteria got better the longer I stayed. Sometimes they even had goat milk shakes in the summer and chicken pate. The guy on the corner would break out a pack of hot dogs now and then. I had my lives. I saw the rise and fall of Tormaktoon, aka Gray and White, not to be mistaken for me, White and Gray. But he had a fluffy bib of white fur that his fat gray neck just sank into like your typical football bully. And he ruled the block from years 1 to 3, but old Bushytail finally triumphed and he had to go. The little Pris, who was my nephew, always in a tuxedo, a genderqueer one, I liked him more when he was tiny and I could hump his ass into submission. He had that whole house, but still liked to come and hang out on my porch and sniff the piles that were left for the ants. Every night when the flesh lumps were sound asleep, I'd hear the whirring sound of the spaceships coming down and they would unload the boxes made out of glycerin bioplastic that melted into the asphalt. Inside were things that looked like coyotes, but they were inhabited by parasitic robots that controlled them, and they roamed the Altadena streets, not looking for opossums or cats or anything, but for data. Data. One time Skills, my opossum buddy, mistook a real coyote for a glycerin coyote and he almost got ate. I ran in and gave it the old 1-2, and after that he was indebted to me for half of a life. I was a good debtor though. I always shared a leftover ant-covered pile with him now and then. Sometimes gave one to the glycerin coyotes too. The night I disappeared, the flesh lumps across the way were playing their noodly dad music, and the other house was blasting some of theirs. It was like Battle of the Bands. I saw the tail end of Hooty, the one they call Bright Orange, who I made babies with in the spring. And I thought, now what is she doing under that fence? So I often followed her. Down dark, there was not the usual rosemary and aster shrub, not even the bin bin line with the skunk smells, but a whole different kind of paneling. It was soft like new moss that pushed back under one's feet, and dark like the moonless light when the street lamp flickers off. Strange, I thought. Woody, I called, but she gave no meow, just crickets. Then shit called, my shit, and I had to answer because that's the way of shits. Usually, you know, like if you're like me and you got gut troubles for the last many years, all those hot dogs, they were good though, you know. You gotta go when it says you gotta go. So I hunched up over a soft mossy spot there was no cover to hide in, and I let the shit ripple through my spine. Felt like a tube of uncooked sausage would never end. That shit just kept on coming. Kept on coming. I swear it was minutes of sausage. Then I turned to pinch the tip off, and I looked over my shoulder, and I saw that the shit wasn't shit, but was a worm god. He had a top hat and a deck of cards, and he said, pick one. So I picked one. It was the 9 of hearts. Who would have thought I could have got a king? But he said, yep, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 lives, time's up. And he opened his jaw, his mouth, his huge maw that had no hinge. Could have swallowed a Buick in there. And up! The last I saw were his fine tooth comb teeth. I was surprised it was the 9 of hearts, though. Could have been the 9 of spades. But this last year was a year of love. And I was loved. And I did love my life.
Everyone, have a great day.